At Designer Shoe Warehouse, we believe that shoes are an important part of, well,
everything. From first steps to first dates, from all-nighters to all-time personal bests.
From building pillow forts to building
a life. For all the big and small moments that make up your whole world, DSW is there. And we've got just the shoes. Find a shoe for every you from brands you love at brag-worthy prices at your DSW store or DSW.com.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Professor Richard Epstein, a senior fellow of the Hoover Institution. He teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago, to introduce me and to my understanding everything about George Stigler, who wrote an essay, the title of which tells the story, Theory of Economic Regulation. It was published in 1971, and we've passed the 50th anniversary of this essay. Richard introduces me to the fact that through these five decades, I've been unaware of its controversy. Richard, a very good evening to you. Thank you very much for this. I'm plunging into 50 years that I missed, thanks to you. If I understand Professor Stigler's presentation about the theory of economic regulation, the regulatory body, the administrative state, he says that regulation must be driven by the public good, except in instances where there's a trade-off. For example, affixing gasoline prices because of national security, that sort of thing. The second thing he says is that regulation can be explained as political, and by that he means it lacks rationality, so that therefore it is the product of an interest group that is not thinking of the general good. That is a generalization about Professor Stigler, but you acquaint us in your essay for Defining Ideas that there have been a range of criticisms of George Stigler all these decades. Good evening to you, Richard.
Yes, good. I mean, look, George was a good friend of mine for about the 19 years that we overlapped at the University of Chicago. And everybody who knows him remembers not only his rather piquant contributions, but his incredibly powerful wit with respect to short-term conversation. He could put people down with a single word. And I think it's probably worth reminding that George was a genuine original. And so I was getting particularly upset at lunch one day with George, not at George, but when he was in the room. And I said, this person doesn't have the slightest idea of what justice means. And George just looked at me and said, either. And what he meant is George was a complete skinnick that there were theories of independent justice that you could develop. He was not a political theorist trying to get the just state. He believed that he was doing descriptive work, which explained how things could go. And oddly enough, he did have a moral norm there, which is he thought that the ideal situation was a competitive industry structure. And so what happens when he writes this thing about regulation, George is faced with the hard question of figuring out what ought to be subject to regulation and what not. When he was a very young man back in the 1930s, George had to come face to face with all of the political rationalizations associated with labor unions on the one hand and agricultural cartels on the other. And his original skepticism of government came from the simple fact that George said, here are markets that could be perfectly competitive or highly competitive. And then what you see is the coming in there and creating monopolies on the part of unions on the one side and of agricultural farmers on the other side, bringing in a kind of a political dimension where there'd be elections to determine total output and so forth. George thought all of this was crazy. Then when he starts to go on and think about it some years later, what he does is he says, I'm going to give you an economic theory of regulation, which explains why it may well be that the public good will determine that we will deal with defenses and nationally funded or roads. But when you actually see the way in which these things operate, who gets what, there's a very strong undercurrent of interest group politics that can shape that. That was his first point. And his second point was, generally speaking, it's the big organized players in industry that will win those particular contexts because they know exactly how to pull the levers of the system and therefore can beat the sort of disorganized public at large. This was a variation on a theme which George does not, I think, sufficiently acknowledge by Jim Buchanan and Gordon Tullock, who wrote a book called The Calculus of Consent in 1962, which developed what we now call public choice theory, an odd term, which means, in effect, when you look at the way in which public the public makes its choices, given elections, committee structures, campaigns, side competition and contributions, lobbying and so forth. It often turns out that what Bismarck said is true. You put in good meat and you come out with rather messy sausage. And George kind of believed that as well. So we were celebrating this, and the contribution that I made was to go back and to read George and to figure out how it is that you'd put this into context. And there were several points, and I'll just sort of let you take it on after this, which I think are really worth noting. First of all, in this entire period, there was an enormous success rate of legislatures to engage in legislation that could be fairly described as confiscatory. And the protection that the large industry got was not from politics. They got it from the United States Supreme Court, which starting in the 1880s and 1890s began to erect some kind of doctrines, not perfect, but important doctrines nonetheless, which was designed to put a check on confiscatory regulation. One of the early cases on this is a case called Smith v. Ames, decided just before 1900, in which what the Nebraska legislature had done is just cut all railroad rates by 25%. And the Supreme Court said, you can't do that. You have to give them a reasonable rate of risk-adjusted return on their capital. And just simply cutting everything down like that doesn't make the grade. And that line of cases, in one form or another, keeps going all the way through the end of the New Deal period. So you can say under these circumstances that these industries were able to do it by themselves. And the second problem is George often gets the wrong winners. That is, he assumes that the large firms were there. If you go back and you check the rhetoric of Franklin Roosevelt and so forth, he was virulently anti-monopolist and took after these companies. He had a very powerful trust-busting attorney general named Thurman Arnold, who later became a member of a law firm called Arnold and Porter, a powerful man and so forth. And they sued these companies on very aggressive and dubious theories and so forth. And so what happens is, if you start looking at the political arena, it's the unions and it's the farmers, large diffuse goods, that manage to organize in one form or another that get all the legislative benefits. And that's just not quite consistent with this theory. And the same thing is true with occupational licensing. Braiders and things like that, they can impose incredibly onerous requirements for new entrants to come into this business. So what you do is you see a lot of George's stuff. Legislation converting competitive industries to monopolies. But the winners aren't the big firms. It's the little groups that are able to overcome the organizational obstacles that make their life difficult. And they did it for a very long period of time. And Roosevelt at the same time would chop off at the really big guys going after Saucony Vacuum Company and so forth with antitrust suits and the like. So I think the sort of institutional awareness, if you start looking at particular cases, says that yes, the interest group's theory of legislation is alive and well. It doesn't always work, but it works a large number of cases. But it doesn't yield the results that George thought, that is, of industry capture.
This is in the news because the Biden administration is introducing, in general, the idea that bigness is to be looked at very closely, in particular by the Federal Trade Commission, that is now using anti-monopoly language, directing at first against social media, but then again, there is another day. What is especially important here, if I understand correctly the news reports, the members of the Biden administration are looking at regulation without legislation, that is, by executive order and by extension of the powers of the executive. So, again, we go to why George Stigler's essay is in the news. The question is, what is the risk, what is the benefit of regulation from the center? I mention, if I read correctly, Richard, that Mr. Stigler believed that in short time, the industry acquires the regulatory regime and makes profit from it. In other words, enjoys it and exercises according to its authority. That makes sense to me when I think about the regulations for airlines or travel. It makes a deal of sense because there's always a way to make money. For example, charging for baggage. Okay, fine. Good for them. I understand also the other aspect of this reaches back to, and this I enjoy, Richard, in your essay, James Madison and the original founder's fear of factions. How does that apply to regulatory bodies in the 21st century?
Yes, well, Madison wrote this essay, which has an incredibly perceptive identification of what the problem is and is utterly helpful for coming
this,
up with
this. This is Federalist number 10. Federalist number 10.
Federalist number 10. And he sort of defines a faction as a permanent aggregate group whose interest is in opposition to that of the nation as a whole. And it turns out that you can have minority factions and you can have majority factions. And it turns out that if conditions are right, the minority faction can, in fact, extract enormous amount of gains. But if it turns out conditions go in the opposite direction, it could be the majority faction that, through vote or some other device, manages to confiscate the wealth of other individuals. So the airlines you mentioned were a classic case of a cartel getting protection against outside entry, and it took a very long time to break that down. It was only in the Carter administration when Alfred Kahn and my friend Michael Levine, as his assistant, managed to do something to open up this particular industry to a degree of competition. Large amounts of that change actually held, but there, of course, is always some backsliding. But on the other hand, if you start looking at the kinds of protections given with respect to labor unions and so forth, what happens is the calculus comes out in a very, very different way. And more importantly, when you start getting into the period of civil rights starting in the 1960s and so forth, the new interest groups essentially sweep the board. And these are things like the AARP, right, for retired people, the ACLU and various civil rights organizations, the dozens upon dozens of environmental groups that are out there being anti-industry and so forth. And what happens is, if you're going to try to figure out what's going on, you can't ignore those kinds of things. In 1971, we're already past Medicare. We're already past Medicaid. We're already past the Voting Rights Act, all which took place in the Johnson years. And George is just not attuned to the kinds of interest group politics that those sorts of statutes create. Now, are these people pro or anti-competitive? You cannot tell simply by knowing that a group is for or against a certain kind of constituency. What you actually have to do is to look at the kind of regulations that are going to be imposed. And so if it turns out that there's a restriction which says that if you're disabled, you cannot hold a certain kind of job, and somebody tries to strike that down, generally speaking, you would regard that as being kind of pro-competitive, at least if the firm has the choice to accept or reject the people who are in that so-called class. But then, on the other hand, if you're dealing with something like disabled people, it's not a question of just lifting the bars to employment. It's now a duty that you have to hire certain people or explain why it is that you cannot make due acceptable accommodations in order to keep them there. So now the regulations become profoundly anti-competitive. And you see that in the Biden administration. The sorts of things that they call competitive are the sorts of things that many competitive firms would never do. Or the practices that they denounce are practices that competitive firms routinely, independently of each other, start to adopt. And so what happens is the word, we are in favor of competition, has become kind of a talisman. Everybody's in favor of competition. Everybody's in favor of the rule of law. The problem is, tell me what the regulation says, and I'll see whether or not it tends to increase industry concentration or do something to kind of...
I want to give more specific examples when we come back, Richard, because a colleague of yours, Cass Sunstein, has written at great length in... objection to George Stigler's observations about how industry acquires the regulatory rules and makes profit of it. When we come back, Richard Epstein is a professor at NYU and the University of Chicago Law Schools, as well as a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, writing and defining ideas of something as up-to-date as the FTC 2021 bigness concerns. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code iHeart or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
This message comes from Greenlight. Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. With Greenlight, you can send money to kids quickly, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on what your kids are spending with real-time notifications. Join millions of parents and kids building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get started risk-free at greenlight.com/iHeart.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.